Well, good evening to all of you, and welcome to the LSE, and welcome to this evening's event. My name is Jürgen Hake. I'm the director of the SOSRIHOC Southeast Asia Center, and I'm also an associate professor in the International Relations Department here at LSE. Before I go about introducing our speaker for tonight, I'd just like to get in a word about our next event. I'd like to flag that because that's really one of our main events of the year, which is the Southeast Asia Forum, which will be happening on the 22nd of May. And that's organized at the Lincoln Center. You can find details on our web pages. We will have a full day's events with four panels and a keynote, and the panels will basically cover topics related to the ASEAN economic community, regional order, politics of selected Southeast Asian countries, as well as the link between politics and foreign policy in another group of selected Southeast Asian states. But anyway, as I said, more details will be available, well, available on our webpage, and I refer you to that. Now, I'm very pleased tonight to be able to welcome and introduce to you Dr. James Gomez, both an academic and a consultant. Dr. Gomez is the executive director of the Asia Center based in Bangkok, which he established or helped to establish in 2015. The Asia Center is an educational social enterprise that seeks to connect peoples and regions through collaborative partnerships. James provides the strategic vision and direction for that center's operations, and he also oversees its human rights program. He has over 25 years of experience working for NGOs, international organizations, research institutes, think tanks, public and private universities, including being professor of communications and associate dean at the School of Communication Arts, at the School of Communication Arts, Bangkok University in Thailand. In tonight's public talk, Dr. Gomez will be examining Southeast Asian civil society engagement with human rights mechanisms that we have, such as the Universal Periodic Review or within the region in terms of the ASEAN Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights. And I think he will also be talking about national human rights institutions. The talk that he will be giving is based on a forthcoming book, or books, if I understood correctly. And I think one of the titles in question is the Universal Periodic Review of Southeast Asia, Civil Society Perspectives. If there are any Twitter users in our audience, please note that the hashtag for today's event is LSE Human Rights. If you do have a cell phone that's not even silent, please put it on silent so as not to disrupt our proceedings. We hope to be able to make available a podcast of the event subject to there being no technical issues. As usual, we will proceed along the lines of the speaker talking for about 40 to 45 minutes, and then we will proceed with Q&A. It's a great pleasure to welcome you again, and thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the introduction, and I'm very happy to be here. it's not the best of times for the region in Southeast Asia, no matter how you look at it. And today I want to put forward this thesis to you for your consideration. My argument is really as it stands, the human rights future is bleak in Southeast Asia. But if there is innovation within civil society, I think there's hope. So that's kind of my central argument today. And the title of my talk is Civil Society and Shrinking Political Space: The Future of Human Rights in Southeast Asia. I think in order for you to appreciate the context of my discussion, it's also good to help you situate me. I have over 15 years of development experience working for different, you know, NGOs and international organizations. I started in the mid-90s, which is in the context of the 1993 Vienna Declaration, where Asian, Southeast Asian civil society groups came to position and demand for human rights recognition within the region. Now, this gave the momentum to many international aid agencies. In those days, we used to speak of democracy promotion. And they gave kind of an injection to civil society, both in terms of expertise and resources. And I used to work for international organization, and part of my mandate was to support the development of human rights mechanisms by giving support to civil society organization. So for many years in the region, I was part of the discourse around setting up an ASEAN regional human rights mechanism. So this was, you know, from the mid-90s. Thereafter, I spent over 10 years at different universities, mostly in political science, international relations. The focus has been on Southeast Asian issues, generally in human rights. Part of the work that we do was in partnership with civil society, but in the last years, it has been increasingly difficult for universities in the region, social science programs, human rights programs, if there are any, to work in partnership with civil society. In the old days, we were able to assemble civil society activists as guest speakers in our classes or be part of a conference, but increasingly we need to justify their presence within the university umbrella. You know, our deans and faculty heads will ask, what's the relevance? We will have to budget for funds, and is it going to be politically problematic? So these are kind of, you know, questions we needed to answer. It is in this response that, you know, several academics and I, we came together to set up the Asia Center as a response to things that we are interested in researching and thinking about, in particular, you know, human rights issues in Southeast Asia. And the work at the Asia Center's human rights program essentially looks at three mechanisms, primarily focused today on the Universal Periodic Review, followed by discussions on the ASEAN Intergovernmental Human Rights Commission and the National human rights institutions. I will also touch briefly on the role of lawyers and together suggest to you what the future may look like if we want to promote and advocate for human rights in Southeast Asia. As I flagged earlier, 1993 is a good timeline. If you are thinking about human rights in the region, 1993 is a good timeline. If you were interested in a scholarly pursuit, then 1993 might also be a good time to look up for articles and reflections of human rights processes in Southeast Asia, because they tend to mirror the political and human rights developments, especially the rise of the different types of mechanisms. So you will find that most of the work, you know, will largely, you know, talk about civil society in the beginning. They will talk about the work of civil society in Southeast Asia, trying to move the agenda of a regional mechanism. A lot of work has been, you know, tracking that. Most of them tend to be journal-length articles. We have very few regional books on human rights in Southeast Asia. You have some on civil society. Increasingly, you will find them, you know, reflecting on the state of the national human rights institutions as well. And the latest is the Universal Periodic Review. And this is one of the primary works of the Asia Center, where we have, you know, organized a conference to reflect about the Universal Periodic Review and the role of Southeast Asia in engaging with that mechanism over the last 8 to 9 years, over 2 cycles, and we are about to start the 3rd cycle soon. If you wanted to anchor that kind of discourse, you know, academic discourse, what have been the approaches? You know, a couple, 3 things come to mind. The realist approach, trying to explain why the region, you know, would want to, you know, sign off on the ASEAN Declaration of Human Rights, or even agree to the setting up of the Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights, even though a lot of them, or a fair bit of them, do not agree. You know, it was a realistic or realist approach to say, okay, you know, there are some pressures, we want some cooperation, we want to link up with the global community. So you know, some scholars, you know, try to say, okay, this is a realist approach. Some take an institutional approach. This has been shown to be weak, especially in the context of ASEAN, because the commission still very much looks at promotion rather than protection, because it doesn't have a legal function. And then, of course, to make claims that, you know, human rights is on the march because, you know, the region is embracing liberal democracy. So that has also been pushed back as contemporary political events show, perhaps, you know, the framework could be a slide back to authoritarianism. So these are, you know, kind of some of the academic markers and contours within which we could think about human rights development in the region. So as I said in the beginning, you know, I want to suggest to you that from where I stand and, you know, taking stock of what the things that are happening in the region, that human rights development looks bleak, but if there's innovation within civil society, I think we may have a chance to try to push that agenda forward. So why the pessimistic view? I think there are 4 variables we need to consider. I think when you engage with development aid agencies, when you engage with civil society groups on the ground, and for me, I do try to include also, you know, academics, especially those who take the position of a public intellectual, has experiencing a shrinking space. I flag that, you know, for those of us who are interested in these issues, you know, even at universities, you know, the space is shrinking, political space to, you know, sort of, you know, engage with civil society and just try to understand what are the challenges they face and how we can kind of explain those challenges. So the first thing that is quite well known, well articulated, is legislation. Across the region, different governments are in different stages of rolling out legislation to shape first the legitimacy of civil society. So the first mechanism is really registration. So to exist, you need to, you know, be legally constituted. And there are different criteria. You know, in Thailand, you have, you know, you could be an association, you could be a foundation. The debate is still going on, and there's resistance still in Cambodia. Singapore makes a distinction between social groups, cultural groups, and political groups need the bar is much higher. Yeah, some countries have additional requirements. Even in Vietnam, you know, even a website needs to be registered. And there's also legislation, you know, covering finance. If I move away from Southeast Asia, if we look at India. India has strict regulations about, you know, foreign funding. In Singapore, you have the Political Donations Act that limits how much money you can, you know, generate from the ground, but also external funding. But more importantly than legislation is the rhetoric. That's very important, the rhetoric and the discourse that the foreigners interfere in domestic affairs, and you get a lot of that in Malaysia. So those are some of the things to keep in mind. There's also monitoring and control of civil society activities. That's policing. You have a lot of that in Thailand now. You have either the military or the police turning up at public activities, at the universities, at the Foreign Correspondents Club, or even, you know, general, you know, public activities that may vaguely touch on politics. They're more concerned if it's on Thailand, perhaps less so if it's on other countries. And then if you are international organizations registered under law in Thailand, you still have reporting obligation once a year. You'll need to meet members of the special branch for interviews and just to demonstrate. So a lot of that is happening there, and, you know, groups, you know, use that as one variable as to why space is limited. This is also matched by the shrinking amount of money that donors are willing to put out. You know, there's not so much development aid these days. So there are more groups, more activities, you know, competing for a smaller amount of pie. I have, you know, regular communications with donors, both because I run Asia Center, but also because I'm interested in this area for academic and research purposes. The simple explanation is, you know, James, we rather give less to many than say no to some. So then what you have is, you have organizations no longer getting support for overheads, institutional costs. You only get support for program costs and only partial. So that, you know, is a big challenge. Some agencies are mindful of the conservative political regimes in power, so they also calibrate the kind of programs they are willing to support. They may be willing to support all issues I think are important, but they would be interested to support environmental issues, gender issues, but not hard political freedom of expression, freedom of religion issues, for example. Civil society is not without problems. There's a need for professionalism within civil society groups. The structures of civil society themselves are archaic. They are top-heavy, you know, depending on under which jurisdiction you are constituted. You have board members that control the functioning of organizations. You have membership-based organizations. It's very consensus-driven. But it takes a long time to come to consensus. You know, corporates are downsizing the board size, you know, having troika type of structures. But, you know, civil society groups still are large. So they are cumbersome and they are not responsive and they are not innovative. Because resources are thin, there's a lot of competition among civil society to grasp the limited supply of resources. So there's competition and polarization. I mean, you will have, you know, two clusters of groups working on the same issues, but when they come to a conference, they won't talk to each other. So these are, you know, problems as well. And then, of course, the impact of China. I think if you look at Southeast Asia, I think it's important, you know, the largest diaspora in Southeast Asia hails from China, historically and in contemporary. When I say diaspora, I just don't mean the people, but institutions, values, and so on. So if you have a quick scan of the region, let's say, you know, that's 10, 15 years, it was not unusual in the past to have Falun Gong expressions in the street, or the Dalai Lama representative, you know, participating in, you know, high-level activities and so on. These days, no. I mean, you can go to Chinatown here and, you know, the Falun Gong is in full display. I mean, you go to Paris, you know, they are in full display. The only country in Southeast Asia that's kind of holds its own is Thailand. You know, in Thailand, if you go to Ratchada just across the Chinese embassy, you will always have them across the road, you know, in the exercise position, you know, and a little placard. But these days, even in Thailand, you know, they put up signs, no exercise allowed, just across the Chinese embassy. So that's just kind of an anecdotal survey of the impact of China, not to discount Confucius Institutes. Thailand has one of the largest, although its motivations are really for free Chinese language education. But experience has shown that once they come on board and they participate in meetings, they also have some impact on some of the kind of political activities and so on, related mostly with China, Taiwan, Falun Gong, and those kinds of things. So collectively, these do have an impact on the space civil society has and how it can sort of advance human rights. And I want to suggest that civil society needs to take stock of these dimensions and be innovative and respond to these challenges if it wants to move forward. So in this regard, I want to kind of give you a quick overview of the three mechanisms plus the role of lawyers that could help support or advance human rights. So I'll start here first with the Universal Periodic Review. So I mentioned the work of the Asia Center. We are flexible. We are not bound by large institutional structures such as a think tank or a university. We are mobile. In that regard, we were able to, you know, take up this project. So what we did was we literally looked at the five reports: the national, the stakeholder, the treaty body reports, the actual review, the recommendations, and so on, and then finally the addendum, you know, which is the state's response. So there are five reports for each country. We did all 10 ASEAN countries plus East Timor, since they have, you know, their pending application to join ASEAN. It's quite, you know, routine these days that you include East Timor as a side, you know, when you discuss ASEAN. So the first cycle, 11 countries, and then the second cycle, another 11 countries. So over a span of 8 years, the Universal Periodic Review second round just finished end of last year. And this is what we found after trawling through all these countries. If you look at the treaty bodies, right, you will find not ideal, but, you know, the gender issues are well articulated. Not ideal, but they are well articulated, because many countries have, you know, signed up, often with reservations, still in ratification process, CEDAW. So through that treaty body reporting, you know, variable as it is for different countries and their capacity to report, you have quite a fair bit of follow-up on women's issues. But again, I say it's not ideal, but it's there. The rights of children, CRC, that's also quite well articulated. It's not uniform across the country, but you have evidence that you can, you know, trawl to make an argument that is available in all the reports over two cycles. The national reports of these countries generously celebrate their achievements, in meeting some of the requirements of CEDAW, CRC, and of course, people with disability. So these are the three major instruments, treaty body instruments, mechanisms that get reported. But of course, I qualify by saying they are not ideal, but they are, you know, decently reported. The rest of the key issues that are articulated with the Universal Periodic Review, and again, is consistent across the 8 years over two cycles, is the campaign against the use of the death penalty. Whether it's arguing for moratorium or, you know, giving, you know, justice some discretion to do away with the death penalty, like in the case in Singapore where there's sufficient evidence of cooperation. This is pretty well articulated. A lot of NGOs submit representations. Another strong issue that's well articulated is the promotion of LGBTI rights. That's also clearly articulated across the 10, 11 countries. Migrant workers' rights are also well articulated, and the rights of refugees. So when you trawl through the report, there's a fairly rich data, both in the summarized version, in the stakeholder report, and if you were tracking between, you know, first cycle and second cycle, you can see the states engaging, and you can see evidence of movement or explanations around these issues. Perhaps my next slide might give you some indication, but I'll flag it up ahead. The reason why these issues are strong, it's simply because the volume of submissions have been high. So for every issue, for every country, there has been a rise in the number of NGOs and the number of submissions. The trend has also moved away from singular submissions to joint submissions in partnership with local, regional, and international organizations. So because of this energy behind these issues in a collaborative and a cooperative manner, these four issues have come to the fore. In that regard, the Universal Periodic Review has been relevant in helping and articulating these issues. However, when it comes to civil and political rights, these are either sidelined or not raised. You see, for the four issues before, the states actually grudgingly do engage, but for the others, they don't. So if you take the case of Malaysia, when you speak about Bumiputra rights, you're not going to be able to get some headway there. If you look at Singapore and you speak about detention without trial, you are not going to get headway there. If you look at Thailand and if you speak about Les Majestés and also the South, you are not going to get headway there. Although Thailand is interesting because there's a coalition of support for the South, the Southern issue. So that seems to be, you know, well articulated, but not for the Les Majestés issue. There's a lot of anxiety around that. If you look at Indonesia, you will have issues about freedom of religious belief, especially for minority religions within Islam. That is also very difficult to articulate. Again, it's silent, sidelined or not raised, and the number of submissions is very thin. In fact, for freedom of religious belief issues, and I quote, you know, indirectly the special rapporteur on this topic, only 2.5% across all of UPR relates to FORB. And it's also similar in terms of the volume of submissions in Southeast Asia. So there's a large discrepancy in terms of the types of issues that are being raised through the mechanism. I did get ahead of myself by suggesting, you know, that those issues that were, you know, well articulated was because of the increase in CSO engagement, and here these are the hard numbers. You will see that in cycle one you had only 592 submissions, and here we are talking about 11 countries, 10 ASEAN plus East Timor, and then you had a decent increase in the second cycle. It's the same with the submissions. You can see they almost kind of double up, 65% for the second cycle, and most of the submissions were joint submissions. So this has, you know, allowed. Yeah. So what this means is, now that we have done the diagnosis, and this is where we bridge the link between, you know, evidence-based research and supporting the work of civil society, is then to put out to civil society groups that if you want to raise the other issues, especially the less articulated issues, the issues related to civil and political rights, some of which I highlighted, then there needs to be more submissions and more cooperation and more articulation if those issues come to the fore. Of course, it remains to be discussed after this articulation, what is the impact? Is there a follow-up, implementation, recommendation? And that's the ongoing debate about the value of this mechanism. The ASEAN Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights, again, it's something that I flag is quite unique to the region, because it was the one thing that the civil society groups in the region could come together. As diverse as they are, as competitive as they are, a lot of them, you know, and I have been, you know, I was hired in 95. And for 10 years, you know, I worked behind the scenes supporting different NGOs as they built momentum towards the establishment of the regional human rights mechanism. And what is interesting here, the whole takeaway, the chronology of the activity is the commission was established, in 2009 in terms of the TOR, before we even had, you know, human rights charter or declaration. It came 3 years later, you know. So that's also interesting. You know, sometimes, you know, the visioning and the policy needs to be in place before you go forward and, you know, set up the instrument and you operationalize the instrument. So it's kind of a chicken and the egg. And the backstory here really is Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, and Vietnam were the ones that were resisting it throughout the discourse. So if you were someone, you know, investigating this area and you thumb through all the different journal articles, you will definitely capture that discourse that these countries were kind of, you know, reticent. You know, they weren't interested and they were resisting. But nevertheless, you know, they came on board, and that's why, you know, some argue you can use the realist approach to explain, you know, why this commission was, you know, even formed. At this period where we are, 2016 to 2018, is the third set of representatives. And there are some challenges, and I will highlight what the key problems are. One, I think it's just that, you know, the ASEAN way, consensus, right? So that continues to be a problematic issue for the working of the organization. It remains an organization that is interested in consultation, which is interested in promotion, whereas, you know, human rights mechanisms are actually legal instruments, ideally, that are enforceable, you know, where you can seek recourse to injustice that you have suffered. It's not a monitoring organization, and you know, the three sets of representatives that have come throughout all the countries, you know, independent. Are they independent from the state, or are they supporting the state agenda? Now, different countries, Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, at different periods of these three rounds of representation, these have been the countries that had representatives who had some of their own backbone. Malaysia also, I think recently, the recent commissioner. So at time to time, you will see a certain flare among these representatives who use their own personal agency to try to, you know, push forward the agenda, even though the mechanism is not set up to do that. But they try to use personal agency to support that. But broadly, you know, it is still seen very much as something that's largely promotional. If you look at the counter discourse, it will simply be, but, you know, this is not set up to be a quasi-judicial, you know, entity. This is what it is, you know. Be patient, you know. But nevertheless, it continues to be a focal point around which different civil society groups try to come together and to try to improve. I mean, after all, it took them 20 years, you know, to try to get this set up. So, you know, who knows, maybe another 20 years to give this some teeth, right? The next set of institutions are the national human rights institutions. You will see just from the years that they have been constituted. Again, the backstory here is there's always a political crisis, a regime change, international pressure, where then as the new regime comes in, it demonstrates that it's not the old political authoritarian regime. So it has to flag some kind of democratic institution. So there you are. Let's set up a human rights institution, right? So if you go and, you know, look at the history of all the different commissions, you will always see there's some big incidents, some international outcry, change in government that would lead to the establishment of the of a human rights commission. And Myanmar, you know, when it signaled that it was opening up, one of the first things it did was to establish a human rights commission. The actual mandates, the quality of the mandates to perform the quasi-judicial function, to investigate, to follow up, varies on paper from country to country. In places like the Philippines, it's very well articulated, you know, on paper, but not well implemented in reality, because these are products of political change. To some extent, these are living organisms. They evolve as the political climate changes. So, again, you know, just looking at the news the last few days, I've been in London for a week, you will see there are some teething problems with among the commissioners in Thailand, and that has now, you know, been reported in the local newspapers, where commissioners don't get along with each other because they have different political values. So this becomes a problem, and then the institution doesn't function according to the Paris Principle, along which you know, human rights commissions are supposed to function. And time to time, the grading of the institution is also affected. In the Malaysian case, you know, it almost slipped to the B grade because of the appointment of the commissioners. Because when you appoint from the old boys network, the old boys political network, then the independence of the institution is called into question. Apart from those dimensions, budget continues to be a problem. The Malaysian government, you know, has cut the budget into half, so they do not have enough money to operate. In the case of Timor-Leste, they do not have enough qualified staff. So while you have these kinds of mechanisms in place, they don't seem to function very well, both because of politics, but also because of financial and staff reasons. I think when we talk about the national human rights institutions, I think it's also important to reflect on countries in the region that do not have it, and obviously to understand why they don't have it. You will find most of these countries, you know, have central political control. In many of these places, it's a singular elite. Like in Malaysia and Thailand and Indonesia, you have competing elites, right? They all want to capture the state so they can harvest benefits directly from the state for themselves. Whereas here, in this country, it's a central political control because it's a singular elite. If you go to Singapore, you know, there's no competing elites. You're either connected to the ruling party or civil service. Or if you are in business, you feed off the gravy train. Very much in Vietnam. So, and Laos too. So, because of that, you have a political culture and a discourse that does not support independence. The singular elite will try to validate its existence from its competency, its technocracy, and saying that, you know, independent institutions are problematic because they affect the effective functioning of the state and the economy. In fact, even if you speak to legal academics and lawyers, they will also make the claim that actually there isn't a need for an extra institution because the legal framework is enough for now. In a big country like Indonesia that has a national human rights institution, it has other challenges because a country like Indonesia is so big, a commission in itself is not enough, so they have multiple commissions for women, for children, and there's an overlap. So there needs to be a clarity in the legal articulation of the mandates of these, you know, three entities. Indonesia is also large, so it needs to have some level of decentralization. If you speak to Indonesian friends, they have different opinions, but generally what I get a sense of is that certain areas that are flashpoints, such as the border areas, especially in Borneo between Kalimantan and Malaysia, those are areas where, you know, some kind of decentralized, you know, representation of the commission may be relevant. So, you see, it's quite complex in terms of this institution. As part of the ecosystem, right, lawyers have a role to play. Because at the end of the day, you know, they will tell you human rights, I mean, you know, we've got to look at the law and so on. So, I think this is something that also needs more articulation, more celebration, more awareness, because they can, because the different mechanisms, you know, work differently or they don't work, perhaps, especially in countries, you know, where they don't have a national human rights institution, if the argument is the legal framework works, then perhaps cost lawyering, you know, lawyers who take up cases for social justice might be a way to go. Additionally, they could also, you know, file complaints using the different mechanisms, you know, say if there's a national human rights institution or make petitions and so on. But however, there's a problem in many of these countries, because if you study law just to, you know, do contracts and intellectual property and those kinds of thing, where then the question of jurisprudence, you know, calling out unjust law, especially when it pertains to rights issue, constitutional challenge, is thin. You have a robust legal fraternity in Malaysia, and that's an active scene. But at the end of the day, you know, is the judiciary independent, right? If you speak to lawyers from the region, especially the cynical ones, they will tell you, well, it's all political, mate, so why even bother? You know, you just go through motion, right? Because at the end of the day, the cronies are all integrated, so there's a problem. So while this is important, it seems that, you know, there's more work to be done. And lawyers in countries where rights are not celebrated, they work in a hostile environment. Again, you know, we have evidence in Singapore, recently in Thailand. You may be barred from practice. You may be disappeared, so on and so forth. So these are all, you know, part of the problem. So if this is the case, right, and these are the challenges, right, so, and if it seems that the space for civil society to operate is restricted, you know, how can we, you know, try to move forward in spite of this constraint? I think for any work, you know, whether it's in academia, personal, or in, you know, civil society issue is no different. I think funding is important. I've been having a round of discussions with, you know, some of the well-known international NGOs based in London. I won't name them just for professional courtesy. But I tell them, point blank, you are a sunset industry. Because, you know, you are here. You don't have boots on the ground. And there's no money to give. Right? So what's the value add? You say you have an Asia program, but, you know, you just have like two countries, you know, Bangladesh and, you know, Indonesia. That's not an Asia program. So I think civil society groups on the ground, and of course I think it's also relevant in other parts of the world, I think self-funding, philanthropy with a small p, self-funded events, may be the way to go. I think bringing in ideas of social enterprise, social business, generating income, which is what Asia Center does. We own 120 square meter space in central Bangkok, and we rent it out as meeting rooms for mostly education type activities, you know, and also, you know, we are in an office building, and people within the office building also use it for their meetings and things like that. Sometimes, you know, civil society groups also use it for training, and that generates about 30% of our income, right? So we are able to run programs through a mixture of donations as well as, you know, applying for grants. So I think this is key, because there's no free money, basically. So that's one way to go. I think the advocacy, sending out alerts, I'm sure if you are interested in these issues, I mean, you know, who even opens the email, right? You know who it comes from. You know, sometimes you are glad that spam gets it to them before you do. So I think advocacy needs to be solution-based. Increasingly, a lot of groups understand that, but you need resources to do evidence-based research. So, and that's why we took that work on the UPR, to demonstrate where the focus is, where the gaps are, so you can direct your energy to those areas where it needs a bit of a push. So I think a solution-based advocacy where you are clear where you are going to give a push might see more results. Civil society groups also tend to work in isolation. I think there needs to be more national and regional collaboration and partnership. We can see from the UPR process that has been effective. In fact, if you look at the UN agencies and if you talk to them about UPR and other types of mechanisms, the pushback will always be come back as a group because there's strength in numbers. If you pick up your issue on your own, it is difficult. So the strength in numbers, and that could be the way to go. Resources is not just about hard cash, it's also about, you know, just knowledge, sharing, networks, and those are quite relevant. Things that we know but that we need to operationalize. And of course, youth engagement. You know, international organizations, you know, I'll name one, Greenpeace, you know, because I didn't meet them. So they are very membership-based. They're very careful with their funding. They value their independence. Great model, I think, but for contemporary times, I think the membership needs to come from the youth. It can be digital membership. I think engaging them at the universities are very important. I think that's your success. But not all young people go to university. So you need to find other ways in other pockets. You know, they are in trade schools, they are in different type of skills institute, and some are already working. So a lot of them are, you know, quite accessible by social media. So investing in social media and youth engagement is also a way to go. And I think a regional approach does have value. Because if you look at Southeast Asia, most people will take a country-specific. You know, if you say policy papers, they say, oh, give me one on Indonesia and one on, you know, Laos. But I think understanding the region as a whole also has some value because, again, you know, it's about building, you know, coalition across national and regional lines. So, in sense, I think some of this innovation can help, you know, overcome the impasse that we have facing the region now with regards to human rights. I've mapped up the different institutions. So I'll kind of just pause here and once again highlight this book. I think it'll be out at the end of the year, so keep a lookout for it. I think it's the first book-length series on this topic. You can contact me if you are in the region or know of somebody in the region. We are running our next conference, which is on the National Human Rights Institutions in Southeast Asia. And again, we will be having a book out of it. And in 2018, in July, we will be convening a conference about the human rights processes in the region, discussing also AICHA and other mechanisms. So if you're interested, you know, I've got my name cards with me. Pick them up. You've got the contact email here. Get involved. And if you represent an institution, you know, we are also happy to partner and collaborate moving forward. So I'll just stop here And
okay, well, yeah, thank you
thank
very,
you very
much. Thanks for that assessment. I think we will take questions individually at first before I group them together later on as time goes by. Who would like to start? Yes, the lady with the glasses, yeah, the third row.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. My name is...
Yeah, just say who you are. That's yeah. Great, and your affiliation, yes.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Kazadira, and I study here at the LSE. I'm actually from Indonesia. I have... two questions. So firstly, you mentioned about professionalization, self-funding, and also like the need for partnership. And I was just wondering whether you think professionalization to a certain extent can generate counterproductive effects for these NGOs, in the sense they might lose sort of their connections to grassroots, or maybe make, in a way, make them too bureaucratic to make innovations. And secondly, also in regards to partnership, do you think that in practice that can actually happen, or is it that it remains sort of just an aspiration that it cannot really be implemented in the ground because some NGOs are more powerful than other NGOs in that respect? And also about this increasing trend towards, you know, disdain for human rights, I was just wondering whether you think there was ever a golden age for human rights in Southeast Asia, or is it that just the space never really expanded at the very first place? Thank you.
So that's going to be three questions.
Yeah, yeah, three questions. I think this whole debate between grassroots and professional staff has been around for quite a while, 10 to 15 years, you know. If you wear a shirt and trousers and a tie, you know, the grassroots champion will be wearing slippers and insist that you are, you know, out of order and out of touch. That same language is also put out against academics. The minute you write something in prose about an issue related to civil society, you'll be labeled as an academic and not a practitioner. So this, I think this, you touched on a core problem within the civil society groups themselves. And I think it's a generational issue. You will find that people who have, you know, been involved in the movement, you know, have come from the grassroots approach. But I think times have changed. There's a different generation that's coming in using different technology. You will find less and less NGOs. You know, if you walked into the region, you know, 20, 25 years ago, they'll be all operating out of a house. You know, tons of books everywhere, papers everywhere, very crowded. Now they work in very, very small, neat, clean offices, you know, downtown, in order to network, to meet people. So that's the way it is. You know, there's no value judgment. I think it's an evolving situation. Partnership, definitely. I mean, you know, pecking order, you know. I mean, being an academic, being an associate dean of international for quite a few years in different universities, I have this firsthand experience, you know. Top-tier universities will never want to sign an MOU with second-tier universities, you know. With the NGOs, it's the same, right? So, but how do you break the impasse? So it's a question of what's your value add? What can you bring to the table? So I think you could network within your range, and you build your coalition from there. Because everybody think their brand is bigger than others, right? So and those are realities. Disdain for human rights. I think the word human rights, the phrase, is still quite contemporary. Up to maybe 10 years or more, you know, at best, dignity. Human dignity. Those were the type of words they used. Human rights is still, I mean, if you go to Japan, you know, and if you talk about human rights or you speak with Japanese people on human rights, it's negative. They're seen as troublemakers. right? So there's that kind of connotation is still there. But I find the more you use it, I think it adds some brand value, right? I'm always, you know, happy to wear human rights on my sleeve. What do you do? Human rights. And, you know, the conversation stops, you know. So.
Okay, there's a lady sort of, I think, four rows from the back, yeah, also with glasses on top of the head.
Thank you. I'm Fang Longxu, the co-director of the LSC Taiwan Research Program. So, I mean, it's very interesting to know your campaign, human rights, in Southeast Asia. Like the four issues, I mean, you list, like the death penalty, LGBTI, and the right for the migrant workers, and also right for refugees. And this just exactly the same, the four major concerns in Taiwan now. So like you also mentioned about the collaboration in with a bit different countries. So I think to my question, I would like to know what things you have covered with Taiwan. And also, I think you also mentioned very one interesting in Southeast Asia because the single elite, so it's difficult to have independence. Yeah, but Taiwan is not a single elite. Taiwan have two political parties, so the elite list. Yeah, so. So I want to know. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's nice to know there's a friend from Taiwan here. Taiwan is very interesting because for many years I worked for one of the German political foundations. And at that time, you know, there was Kim Dae-jung and there were experiments which eventually led to the setting up of the Korean Democracy Foundation. So I was very much involved in the backroom discussion that led up to the setting up of the Taiwan Democracy, Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, which came on the back of the Chen Shui-bian government, the DPP. In fact, the Asia Center conceptualization was supported. I received a human rights research and training fellowship from the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, and I spent a couple of months at Zhengji Dashui to do some work. So, but and I just speak about this particular institution, which I know quite well, but you are also affected by the politics. So when the DPP was in power and you have the appropriate board members, the work of the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy was different. You know, it was supporting NGOs and civil society groups for human rights work, even though only now you are thinking about setting up a national human rights institution. But the minute the Kuomintang came into power, you know, then all the projects were about sending, you know, the representatives to China. You know, so even an institution that supports, you know, human rights and civil society work, you know, you are affected by your politics. And I think, I don't know, I mean, it'd be nice if these are divorced, you know, from the political interference and the party cronies, and so it can do its work. And the final word on Taiwan Foundation for Democracy is you have limited funds. And therefore, their approach has been what I've articulated earlier. We give less to more because Taiwan needs more friends. So these are some of the realities. But I thank you for the question. Yeah.
Mm. First of all, there's a gentleman, yeah, sitting right behind.
Thank you very much. Yes, hello. My name is Michael Rainsborough. I'm head of the Department of War Studies at King's College London. James, you and I go back quite a long time, don't we? Best part of 20 years. And I hope I'm not offending your modesty by saying that I remember you very much as a very brave human rights advocate in Singapore when you and I first met. And my question is very straightforward. You know, you've described very very succinctly the sort of shrinking civil society space in Southeast Asia. At the same time, we also know that some countries, some universities in Southeast Asia, they're actually rather good at co-opting Western university institutions and sometimes individual Western academics through institutional links. And I was just wondering, given the shrinking civil society space, what sort of responsibilities, ethical sort of responsibilities, do you think actually fall on Western institutions which do seek to sort of extend their linkages in the region and individual scholars who also seek to study the area in this particular sort of environment that you have spoken so clearly and eloquently of? Thank you.
Yeah, I think I kind of flagged it slightly in the front when I mentioned there are challenges within academic institution because, you know, some of us are interested in working with issues related to civil society, and when you want to study and participate, you know, you need to embrace that, you know, that field, the civil society field, and bring people into the classroom, you know, interact with the students and you know, get involved in field research and so on. Because I've spent some years in the role of the Associate Dean for International, I mean, it's the hunt for students, right? So whether it's Australia, whether it's UK, whether it's North America, especially in countries where, you know, English medium education. They do deals, you know, they bring their branding, first year, second year branding, and they try to co-brand with the local institutions in the region. And primarily it's for student recruitment, whether they sell you 1+2, 2+2, you know, It's motivated by economics, not so much by ethics or the pursuit of academia. Individuals is a bit different because I think, you know, everybody is cut differently. And this is not just unique to academics. I think you also find that in the civil society sector. You have career risks. So the minute you get them, when they come into an institution, that's all they are. They're thinking about themselves, their next job, the next wage, the next posting. You know, and it's not just for academics, but also, I think, for civil society professionals. You know, you can have a human rights institution, but if you get the wrong person into the role, they may be using that position to springboard to the next project or to the next appointment. So you have a lot of that, but you know, and because I come from Singapore and there's a lot of that happening in Singapore, it's mostly because of the wage. We're talking about individual positions, and that's the only country in Singapore that pays that wage. The minute you say Thailand, nobody comes because the wage is not great, right? So but are they happy? Generally not. They'll come, they'll suck it up for 3 years, and then they'll move on. You know, it's really how much you can stomach. Or if you go to Malaysian public universities, you're right. If you try to, you know, log on to Malaysia Kini, you know, the academics will run away. You know, they'll talk about everything else except Malaysian politics, right? So these are the reality, and that's why I think increasingly the university, you know, is a problematic area. I think it's not, it doesn't give you the independent space, the free intellectual space to think and do what you want. And that's fair enough. You know, I mean, you buy into the system, you take a wage, you know, there's conflict of interest and so on and so forth. So if you want to do your stuff independently, then you just do it outside, right? And that's the rationale behind setting up the Asia Center, that you can do all of that but you don't have to be housed within a university structure. And I think it's problematic now because I have people from universities coming to me and saying, hey, this is a great outfit. Can we send students to you for internship and experiential learning? And, you know, my rejoinder is, I can't be doing your job, right? Because the fee is paid to you and your institution. I mean, of course, if you pay us a fee, we are happy to put a program together. But otherwise, you know, don't farm off your work to somewhere else, you know. And that's what's happening. You know, they're running a racket, I tell you. Yeah, so I'm just being naughty. So.
Okay, let's collect a few questions. So I think the gentleman here in the front, yeah, we'll start with you. Then we'll go to Bill Hayton at the very end. I'll come to more of you. And then maybe the lady over there, yeah? So those three will be the next three questioners.
My name is Alan LaRue. I'm a UK-based lawyer. I've also done a little work in human rights in Southeast Asia. You mentioned lawyers being part of the solution. You also hinted at hostile environments in some of the countries in the region. Now, I know that in a number of countries in the region, courts are not simply holding governments' executives to account. There are situations where they've actually been co-opted into repressive regimes and judicial harassment is a very real problem. So what I'm wondering is whether you've ever seen a peaceable or constitutional legal solution to such a situation, and further, what might your thoughts be on positive solutions to such situations generally? Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello, thank you. That was really interesting. I apologize, I was a little bit late, so I hope you didn't cover this already. But my question, I mean, it's Bill Hayton, I'm an associate fellow at Chatham House. It's related to the sort of macro political environment. And I just wonder whether you would agree with this. I mean, it seems that for 25 years, 1990 to 2015, there was very little great power competition in Southeast Asia. The pressure was pretty much all one way. It was America pushing. It was in the direction of liberalization, economic, social, political. We're in a very different era now. And I wondered how you thought that will impact on pressure for human rights generally, whether you think it's going to go backwards as states put great power competition first and human rights issues second, or whether you think that because of class changes, demographic changes in these countries, that the pressure is now endogenous, coming from within rather than from without. Thank you.
Thank you. And then sort of here in the middle of the room. Yes.
Hi, I'm Riri Sundrijo. I'm actually from University of Warwick, a second year student, a PhD student. I would like to elaborate your statement earlier when you said that personal agency is used to push forward agenda within HR. My main question is, how do you think is how important is the role of personal agency, the role of individual in the process of starting up in 2007 when the process of HR institutionalization and even now? Because in Southeast Asia, we are familiar with track two, track three, but at the same time, we know that there are such a big name in human rights area like Ravendi Jamin, RP Santiago. I mean, so is it really a civil society movement, or actually the movement is really run by certain individual in Southeast Asia. Thank you.
Okay. So all very interesting. You know, the question about constitutional solutions, and interestingly enough, I had some discussions these few days with some lawyers, and because I'm not very well informed in this area. What I was told is, the programs that are being offered are thin on constitutional and jurisprudence matters. Therefore, you have a suite of lawyers that are coming out from the region that are doing a lot of contract work, conveyancing work, and other form of legal work, which is also now increasingly challenged because of the oversupply of lawyers and digitization of the legal industry. And therefore, there are not enough training on constitutional matters, and that's why it's thin. There's some encouragement, perhaps people with some, you know, first career experience, you know, who may take up a JD program and then may have that maturity and may be in a position to explore. I mean, course lawyering professionally, you know, so it's not about how much money you make in terms of how much contracts you close, but really about, you know, issues of justice and jurisprudence and all of that. But, you know, I can only speak of the Singapore case, which I know quite well, but it's not very encouraging because the people who are drawn to the legal profession, you know, are motivated by the non-constitutional and non-jurisprudence type of issues. So there is a lack, and I think if lawyers, you know, in the region, you know, to get a leg up, you know, some kind of support in those areas may be critical. Yes, the question on global power interplay, I did very, you know, briefly touch upon it. I think the key challenge in Southeast Asia is really the impact of China. And the Chinese diaspora, which is, you know, just beyond people, but institution, values, and other things that's impacting the region in a big way. Because we all have so many students from the mainland, and one of my students is here, my ex-students who I met from China. They bring forth a lot of values into the class. So if I may use my experience from Australia and Bangkok, you know, the teachers are questioned. You know, for example, in Australia, when I was teaching a course on political communication, I had a student from China who came to me before the program and said to me she would like all the three courses on, you know, election advertising, political communication, and NGO communication to be removed and to be replaced by more business communication. So I said, perhaps then this may not be the course for her because, you know, I don't have the rights to just change the topics as I like. You know, the Senate has approved the course outline and program, you know. But those are the daily, you know, challenges we have. And I said, if really if she was interested in those kinds of things, then perhaps a business program might be more suited for her. But if you have, you know, class discussions, if you raise the issue of the Falun Gong, it's very explosive in class because, you know, you get the stock answer that Falun Gong is no good. So this impacts you on a daily basis in the program. Would India be a counterbalance? I think no. Not at this stage. I mean, India has so much internal problems. I mean, it's not ready to exert, you know, external influence. It's got no money. You know, it doesn't have the reach that China has in the region. So I think that's...
endogenous rather than India. So, I mean, whether it's from within these societies...
Oh, yeah. Right. So I think that argument, you know, the middle class will rise. No, I mean the middle class, you know, are there. They are consuming the wealth, but they are not participating. In fact, I think they are part of the problem. Yeah. So because they like the status quo. Yeah. So the middle class, no, not a part of the problem. This is a very interesting question. I think I would say certain individuals, because they are larger than life, and you know, Rafandi is one of them, and also there's, you know, in Thailand you had previously, and also in Malaysia now, they have some agency, personal agency, but I think the agency is not good enough to move the regional mechanism forward, because ultimately, you know, agency, you know, doesn't immediately translate and change the institution, because you need legal change, you know, for it to be a quasi-judicial body. Are they larger than life? Yes. I mean, we call them the one-person NGOs, you know, who are so huge. And, you know, someone like Rafandi, yes, will be well-positioned in Indonesia, will be very attractive for some kind of regional position. But still, you know, you need others to work together. I mean, the profile is helpful. To get publicity, to be a speaker, to engage with the media, to build confidence with donors. But for the implementation of issues on the ground, I think you need a team. I think it's not one person's work, you know. Yeah, so that's why we're happy to chat with you further. Thank you.
Okay, I think we do have time for one more round of questions. There's a gentleman here on my left. If you could start, and then we will come to you, John.
Dr. Yunus Rice, my question is, are you referring to human rights in a very restricted manner applicable to the civil society, which appears to be only a small part of the human race? Secondly, is a comment. They said Nietzsche killed God. Nietzsche never killed God. Nietzsche declared God dead. God was killed by the two world wars. And the Human Rights Foundation tried to revive God, but they forgot morality and humanity. And that is where the problem lies. You may not agree with my comment, but that's what I think. Thank you.
Well, thank you. John.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. I work with the Southeast Asia Centre here, but before that I was a consultant for a human rights NGO in Cambodia called Likado, where I focused mainly on advocacy. And there's kind of two parts to my question. One is in terms of donors and aid towards NGOs in Southeast Asia, not just Southeast Asia but globally, and the conditions that are attached to the aid that are that is given to these NGOs. From my experience working in Cambodia, a lot of our time, our resources and manpower was gone into satisfying the conditions of this aid, into filing reports, and a lot of resources were taken away from advocacy activities, specifically field investigations, filing reports, and working with our partners, particularly FIDH and Forum Asia in Bangkok. And I just wanted to kind of frame that and say, you know, is there an onus on donors, particularly US aid, from my experience, are incredibly aggressive. And there was a lot of pushback within Cambodian civil society against US aid, so much so they had to bring in more senior staff to help sort out the funding because it wasn't getting spent because there was pushback against US. Then on the other side, you've got the Cambodian government who's getting a lot of investment from China. This is building on what Bill said earlier. I'll just give you two examples. In 2010, the Cambodian government extradited, returned a group of Uyghurs, violating their right to non-refoulement. About a week later after that, Xi Jinping arrived in Phnom Penh, who was then vice president, and donated $1.2 billion in economic aid. And then in the geopolitical context, last year, when Cambodia successfully kind of blocked an stronger ASEAN statement on the South China Sea, blocking any mention to the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and then it was given $530 million of aid. You know, how, with those two dynamics and squeezing the space particularly from exogenous sources, where can civil society go in terms of working through that?
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions in the room? If that is not the case, then we will just, you know, focus on these two and then...
Yeah, with Dato's question, well, although I'm speaking about civil society, but, you know, I think human rights is for all, you know, so that's really what I mean. I think civil society is just a group, a tier of society that campaigns on these issues, because I think different parts of society do different kinds of advocacy. You know, China has been close to the region, very close to Cambodia for a long time. You know, we used to have meetings with representatives from different political parties and governments, and, you know, the Chinese ambassador would immediately know the next day if there was a discussion involving Taiwan. Immediately, the ambassador will raise a complaint about why is Cambodia or the Hun Sen party representative, you know, inviting Taiwan, and there'll be all attempts to block. Xinhua News Agency officers will come and take pictures of who's participating in the different activities. Those are the things that we used to deal with in the early 90s. But now, of course, it's like, you know, Big Eight. I think how civil society can operate, I think as long as you don't take money from China, you're okay. Yeah. That's the fact, because you have your independence. But I think civil society also needs to be mindful of how China operates. I recall in the early 2010, I attended the WIS meeting, the World Internet Society meeting, that was hosted by the Japanese government. And it was, you know, also open to civil society to try to formulate, you know, free rules of engagement over the internet. Basically, that's what it was. And the Japanese justice minister was opening the talk, you know, giving welcome remarks. And, you know, all the NGOs, donors were right at the back, because, you know, the states were the primary candidates. And as the Japanese minister was speaking, there was a loud banging sound somewhere in the front. And we were just wondering what it was, you know, because... And suddenly we saw a very small person, a man, was holding the placard. It said China. And was banging to get attention, because it was out of protocol to interrupt the minister. So the chair said, look, it seems like somebody really wants the attention. So may I excuse the minister and, you know, say, I mean, it seems urgent, you know, so what's going on? And then the delegate from China said that this is a meeting for state, and therefore NGOs are not allowed. At that moment, you know, we didn't really know what was the issue, you know. But we later found out, because there were some Taiwanese NGOs in the delegation. So he moved the motion, the delegate from China moved the motion to kind of basically remove the NGOs from the observer chairs in the room. And as the motion was read, you had all the countries, Bangladesh, Nepal, Malaysia, all standing up and voting to support the Chinese motion to throw the NGOs out. We had one lone, and they were all, you know, old male gentlemen, you know. And we had one young female representative from Australia who was arguing that it's okay, you know, because they are just observers. So that's the power of the impact. And I think as long as NGOs are aware, I think they can navigate the system. Not ideal, because China really has no impact on, you know, Southeast Asian NGOs at all. Mm-hmm. Only through the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the states also have only, I mean, they take Chinese money, but at the same time, they also have some dignity. So they are only willing to go so far to suppress their own people and their own organization. So there is some tension, yeah. And, you know, money is not forever, and, you know, China may be around for the next 50 years, and then you got to deal with India, you know. So I think it's cyclical, you know, but they just, you know, how you navigate. So I'll just stop here. Not very optimistic, but, you know, that's all I got.
Okay, well, we then will draw this to a close, as we have run out of time anyway. Thank you, James, for sharing your perspective on this very important topic. I'd like to also thank our audience for asking some incisive questions. And please join me now in thanking our speaker for taking time.
Thank you.